Here at the In the Money Players podcast, we are proud to partner with the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. Their mission is simple: saving thoroughbred racehorses no longer able to race. And they do more than that, too. They're also helping save people's lives through the TRF Second Chances program. You can read all about it at their website, trfinc.org. And if you want to make a donation, which we encourage all of our listeners to do, please do so through trfinc.org/players, our custom link. We want to show how horse players believe in this cause. That link, again, trfinc.org/players. You're listening to the In the Money Players Podcast. Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornatale, back with you in the Brooklyn Bunker once again. Really excited about today's guest. This is somebody I've talked to a lot off the air. I think we did an article once for the DRF back in the day, but he really deserves a proper sit down. And what better excuse than his big win in the Belmont Stakes Challenge than to bring in Blake Jesse. Blake, how are you today?
Doing well, Pete. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start at the end and talk about this Belmont contest. What were the horses for you that put you into contention, and how did you take it home?
Well, it was a tough contest, really, starting out. But really, I only had one score, and that was what propelled me to the win, and that was in the Woody Stevens, Hog Creek Hustle, and Baracho.
Very nice. Very nice. What? Tell us about the tournament up to that point. I mean, were you just bleeding money? Were you short stacked at that point, or were you just sort of trading dollars?
I was extremely short stacked. Yeah, I think I had about 1150 going into that Woody Stevens, and I bet it all. So I was all in going into that race.
Oh, wow.
It was not a good start, say the least.
Did you have one entry or two heading in?
Just one entry.
And what type of preparation do you do in advance of a contest like that? I mean, did you have a big swing you took earlier that didn't go well, or were you more betting minimums up to that point and just trying to be alive to bigger opinions later? What type of planning do you do as a player to prepare for these big live bankroll events?
You know, I mean, I guess I just really, try to look at the card in advance and get a feel for it and try to find some spots that, I feel like I can leverage the majority of my bankroll on to try to make a score.
Which spots had you targeted ahead of there?
Well, I mean, obviously the World of Trouble race looked like it could be very chalky, but it also looked like it, maybe something that you could, cold deck and, put yourself in a good spot going into Saturday. Unfortunately, I did hit the race, but I didn't hit it the way that I wanted to. So I bled a little money there. I bet all my minimums on Friday, and I was, contemplating going all in on Friday, and I just wasn't hitting anything, didn't have any, luck early on. So, playing in a lot of these contests, I've learned that you want to give yourself a chance, at least. If you're not doing good on day one, just give yourself a chance to come back on day two and, try to make something happen.
Let's fast forward to day two and talk about Hog Creek Hustle. I know a lot of podcast listeners have had this horse on the radar since I think Paul and Duke Matisse talked about him ahead of the last race and led us to a nice exacta. So folks are definitely familiar with him on the show. What did you like about the horse, and how did you go about putting your all-in bet together?
Well, it's pretty simple, really. Hog Creek Hustle, since being turned back to sprint races, one turn races, is shown a much better edge to him. And the Woody Stevens this year, I thought, was going to be a race that had every opportunity for a pace collapse, and I just felt like the 3, 6 and the 8 were going to be the horses that had the best opportunity to pick up the pieces, and they were going to have value. And it's just Pete, a lot of these big races, they're chalky, but every once in a while you catch a Woody Stevens that has a full field of horses, and there's a lot of parity. That's what it takes really to catch a good score. It's going to take a full field of horses that you can make a case for just about each of them.
In this day and age, we've talked about this before in the show, when you got a lot of very accurate speed figures out there, speed figures really help make the market like nothing else. And when you can find a situation that means that it's not necessarily the fastest horse that's going to have the advantage, but the one who it sets up for, situations like pace extremes, right? Lone front runners have that opportunity.
Absolutely.
Pace collapses are the other one. I feel like so many of the long shots come from those two buckets. When you're doing your pace analysis, Blake, what are you looking at? How is it as simple as, oh, there's a lot of horses who want to go to the front in here? Are you looking at pace figures? Does the field size have to do with it? How do you make those determinations?
Well, yeah, I definitely have to say I'm a trip handicapper. I'm looking at the past performances and trying to, put together how the race is going to shape up and how it's going to unfold. So I'm immediately looking for pace. Who's going to be, setting the fractions? Who's going to be stalking the fractions? And who's going to be, far out of it, and that sort of thing. So I just try to visualize where each horse is going to be setting at the first quarter mark. And then just kind of break the race down from there, and I'll go ahead and kind of throw in track bias into my analysis, and just try to formulate something that can that can happen, and that has value.
Did that give you any pause over the weekend? It did seem that the inside was certainly good. Hog Creek Hustle overcame it. Were you worried about the collapse happening because of the way the track was playing? Do you
You
de
know,
yeah.
Pete, I honestly, I was concerned, but when you're desperate and you're down to your last bullet, so to speak, you can't really second guess yourself. You got to go with what you handicapped, and that's luckily that's the way it worked out this time. But yeah, it was a golden rail. I'm in agreement with everybody just about that I've spoke to. It is odd that the one race I hit, seems like the bias was able to be overcome. But yeah, that's a good point. I was a little bit nervous about that.
But I put it down to that same idea, the same way that pace scenarios can overcome important signal like speed figures. I think they can also overcome important signal like bias, and it probably helped. I mean, that crowd was such a wise guy. I'll never get over the come dancing midnight Basu betting when the crowd is so in tuned to the bias that the prices of those two are flipped from what I think they would have been on a fair
Can't
track.
agree more. Cannot agree more. I mean, that is very well put. That's I would have bet my life the day before that BC would have went favored.
But I think that maybe that helped you in terms of the price you got on your bets. Tell us a little more specifically, like exactly how you played that wager. I mean, were you boxing? Were you
Yeah.
keying? Were you looking at
No,
probables?
I very simple. I keyed the 3 and 8 in third. I played a $20 try. I used all the horses I felt like that had a chance to win in first and second, and keyed the 3 and 8 in third, and had to sweat out an inquiry,
Oh, let's
which
talk
I
about
will
that.
say easily I'll go ahead and admit I thought I was coming down, and I easily could have come down. I mean, I'm not going to be one of those guys that's going to stand up here and say that the stewards made a terrific call and this and that. I've played this game since I was in diapers just about, and trust me, I can tell you that you just got to thank your lucky stars when you get one like that.
It was a true 50-50 for me. For me, it was the right call in that I believe when he went around the other horse so easily, it just watching races as often as you do, without that trouble, I just don't see a horse who was beaten to that degree before it happened re-rallying to beat him. Now, granted, under super confusing USA Category 2 rules, you can make a case he still would have run better than he did, potentially, warranting the DQ. But for me, I thought it was the right call because of that. It did make me think about how much clearer of a call it would be in Category 1, and I'd certainly be in favor of some punishment for the jock for shutting the other horse off like that. Objectively, take yourself out of the equation. How do you see it?
Well, yeah, taking myself out of the equation, I feel, I can tell you that, knowing some of the variables afterwards, Johnny V, he told the stewards that his mount was, basically out of run at that point. So you really got to, give him, some applause to him, because most guys in that situation probably aren't going to, be able to have the cool headedness to, say that, their mount was tiring. And yeah, although they did get, kind of sawed off a little bit, they, had the class to, tell the truth at least. And that's, I think that's kind of rare in this day and age. So I think that, is, very important to this story, is that, the rider that was affected is out front and telling everybody that it didn't matter. So
right. That's interesting. That's, I hadn't heard that actually until you just reported it to me there. That's really interesting. Let's return to the contest though, Blake. So there at that point, you had what? Something on the order of 60,000, your nearest competitor. I think it was, might have even been Mr. Kinchin at that point in the high, in the high 20s. What is your, how are you game theorying from there and how did it play out?
Sure. I think I was, had about a $35,000 lead, which, that's, it's pretty comfortable. I mean, nothing's, certain by any means, but it was a comfortable lead. So I had a couple mandatories I still had to play after that. And, I got those in, and, that was, I got my last mandatory in prior to the Belmont. So going into the Belmont, I had about a, I believe a $32,000 lead. I made a small bet, just what I liked in the race, just kind of, if this comes in, I'll be mad if I don't have it type thing. Mm-hmm. And, I just hope that, nobody down, because I felt like at that point, the guys that were really going to be a threat to me were the guys that had $1,000 or, $1,500 that were just going to take a stab at a straight number, or, some type of cold number in the last race. And, luckily that didn't happen, but that was kind of my thought process. It was such a big lead that I felt comfortable that someone was really going to have to cold deck something, or, play some crazy, something out of their comfort zone to try and catch me.
You definitely make a good point about having them come to get you as opposed to a situation where you really needed to protect the lead. The lead was big enough. Also, did the field size enter into it? We're not talking about some 200 runner live bank contest here. Under that circumstance, would you have felt more pressure to bet, or in you in general feel like you want to make them come to you?
Yeah, that's a good point. And something like the BCBC, where there's, several hundred entries, I probably would have, probably played my opinion a little bit more strong, so to speak, just because you have, the more volume of players there are, better chance someone could, stab it and, run you down. But that definitely did come into play. There was probably, I think at the time it was a 60 players total, but there was only about 55 with money left, I believe, going into the last race. So, and of those 55, I would say half of them were, a major threat to, somewhat of a threat to me. So, yeah, that did come into play. I felt, there's not that many people behind me really. So it would be kind of like a mathematical anomaly if they caught me in a way.
I think that sounds about right. What did you end up walking with in terms of your total haul?
Total haul would have been, 58,000 cash and then 60,000 prize. and a seat to next year's Belmont and a BCBC entry.
That's a pretty good haul right there. Is that is that your best result in a single contest?
Yeah, that is. I did finish seventh or eighth this year in the BCBC, so that was a good score as well. But yeah, this is by far the best result for me.
You said before that you've been playing the horses since you were in diapers. How much of an exaggeration is that?
It's pre-adolescence, but I wasn't in diapers, no.
Pre-adolescence is pretty good though. Tell us how you got started.
My father, he just one day said that we're going to go somewhere. So he took me to the track and he played a $2 exacta for me, straight exacta every race when I was a kid to go. And that's kind of how it started. And, I was always into sports growing up. So it kind of just went hand in hand for me. I got the bug and it's stuck ever since.
Which track were you going to back in the day?
River Downs was the first track I ever attended. It's since been renovated and turned into Belterra Park. But that was the first track I visited. And then shortly after that, Indiana got racetracks, and Hoosier Park was the track that I would frequent the most.
Where did you grow up? Between those two?
Yeah, just outside of Indianapolis, a town called Noblesville.
Now, a lot of these stories that horse players have, there are common elements to what I call the origin story. You've already hit on one of them, the older relative who sort of mentors you. Almost all of these stories also have an early big score. Do you have one of those?
I have a memory of when I was a kid, we were going skiing up north to Michigan. So we were all packed in the car driving up, and this was on New Year's Eve. And my dad said, well, we're going to stop at the horse track on the way. So we stopped, and it was a 2-year-old Southern California race. It was a stakes race for cowbreds on New Year's Eve. And I convinced my dad to give me $20, and I bet $5 across the board on a 30-to-1 shot. And, it was cool being, so young and, having your dad and your uncle ask you for money, it was a good feeling, So that's a memory that I'll never forget.
How old are you at this time? And your memory is such, I can't believe if you'll remember this, but do you remember at the age you were why you liked this horse?
Yeah, I was 12 years old and I liked the horse because Corey Black was riding, and I was obsessed with closers. I loved watching horses close, and this horse was a huge closer. And I said, I think this horse can run them all down, Dad. He said, you're out of your mind. He's 30-to-1. You're just wasting your money. And the rest is history.
Another thing I love to ask of people who have such a clear handicapping mentor as you did in your dad, the sort of double question of what's a lesson that you really remember learning from that person and what's a lesson you had to learn on your own?
Oh man, I know the best lesson I ever learned was you take friends to the track. You don't make friends at the track.
Explain what you mean by that. That sounds interesting.
Well, the track, you'll walk in and, nothing against it because this is the industry I live and work in. But, you're always going to find, this guy over here that's got some sort of history. This guy over here that's got some sort of colorful past. And it's, not necessarily the place you'd want to find a mentor for your son or your daughter, So I just remember my dad always saying, he's like, this is a place you really don't want to, meet friends. You just want to take friends here. I was like, all right, Dad, thanks.
Do you feel like handicapping contests have changed that dynamic?
Yeah, it has. The whole contest scene is something that is a breath of fresh air for me as far as that goes, because it's somewhat of a brotherhood in a way. Everybody's there to help each other, and Opinions are thrown off of each other, and wisecracks are made on each other. It's a great camaraderie.
Back to the mentor question, in terms of the lesson you had to learn on your own, what would you say that one was?
Money management. I mean, that's, you can have that preached to you all you want, but until you get in the trenches and really have to, tussle with it, you'll, you really have to have a respect for that, because as much as I love this game, you have to find a way to be able to, stay in it every day, or else, you're not giving yourself a chance.
Now, a lot of people listening probably don't know this is very much the voice of experience, because there was a time between your youthful exploits you were describing before and your professional career, which we'll get to later in racing, where you supported yourself by playing the horses. How did that idea come up? How did it develop? What was that experience like? And again, give us a sense of where you were on the age curve here.
Yeah, I was in my early 20s, mid 20s. And, it's, I tell this to people all the time. There was nothing great about it. It was, it was survival. It wasn't, anything lavish to it. It's a very tough, thing to achieve, because, it's simple. Some days you go to work and you come home with less money than what you started with. It's not fun. And it makes it even harder when you got deadlines to meet and bills to pay. It's not an easy thing to achieve. So anybody out there doing it, I have the greatest amount of respect for them, because it takes a special type of person to pull it off. And I feel like with each day that goes by, the betting public becomes smarter and smarter and smarter. And it's not any easier to make money.
How long did you play for your source of income? And were you tempted, I mean, just the obvious question, were you tempted to drive a cab or stand behind a bar or be a UPS guy or do anything else? Like, why racing?
Well, racing was something that I just had a passion and a love for it. Some things just get your attention and others don't. And this is something that just, when I wake up each day, this is, every day I wake up, this is what I want to do. And there's nothing else that gave me that urge in life, really.
What was your highest completed level of education before you dove into the racing stuff?
I didn't graduate from college. I was 2 years in, and that's kind of where I was. I had to ask myself that question of, what am I doing? Because I just felt like I was wasting money and time, not knowing exactly what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So that's kind of when I decided I'm gonna, go full force at this horse thing and, see what I can do.
How long did that period last?
Oh man. All the way until my current job.
Wow.
So I mean, that's how I, survived.
10 years are we talking at that point?
Yeah, from age, I'd say age 20, 2 to 32.
And what was your roadmap? I mean, where there's no, Mike Maloney hadn't written his book. There wasn't really a roadmap on becoming a pro player. How did you educate yourself and come up with your business plan, as it were?
Yeah, well, it's simple. My business plan was to, try to not leak money, and, do everything I could to bring money on. So, I would play very close to the vest. It's you can't play every race. That's for certain. But, I would just pick and choose my spots. And, one thing I can tell you is my volume is much higher today than it was back then.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and I credit that really to, playing on short money. It's when you're playing on a shorter bankroll, you really have to be right, more often. So you don't spread it around as much, I guess. Yeah, so my goal each day was to really just try to make a few hundred dollars. And if I could make more than that without, having to, put too much risk out there, then that was great. But, every day that I could play, get some churn, make some money, that was great.
Any particular stories, either memorable wins or losses that come to your mind when you think about that decade spent when you were grinding?
Pete, there's so many months where the landlord was, just as happy as me, when I would make a hit. So it's hard to, there's so many, honestly.
So you had that experience that so many, I mean, grinders, right, is the right word, because poker,
Yeah,
wherever.
absolutely. It's a grind every day. You feel like you're fighting for your life just to keep your head above water. And, but somehow you wake up every day wanting to do it. I mean, it's amazing. It really is. But I have to thank my family and my friends, because they were all very supportive. And I think that a lot of people would have questioned me and, said, "Hey, maybe you should be doing something else with your time." But my family is very supportive, and if they weren't, I don't know if I'd, be where I'm at today. So, I did have a good support network.
Let's talk about the transition into your current role. Was there one thing that happened that made you fed up with the grinder's life, or did you just sort of get to the end of your tether from all the stress that must have come with what you've been describing?
That's exactly it. It was stress, and I'm becoming an older guy at this point, and my then girlfriend was, encouraging me, "Hey, we need to settle down and, start a family," and that sort of thing. So that was really the I would have to put that on my wife. She was very adamant, like, "Hey, probably should get a job, like one that people, understand."
Oh, that's amazing. All right, so now go back there. How did you start? I mean, what's your resume looking like at this point? And how
You know,
did you
it's so funny you say that, because my resume, when I reached out to Ron was, I can give you some, I have a few, people that I can give you their number, they can verify me and all that. I said, "But really the best thing I can give you is my betting history. I mean, that's going to tell you what type of person I am." And, he kind of laughed and,
That's great.
but he, Ron and I, I'd have to say I'm the luckiest guy in the world to have, gotten to meet him and work for him, because we really do meld well. He's a very eccentric guy, and I feel like that, we're a good team. So.
Ron, of course, for those who don't know, is Ron Paolucci of Looch Racing. And Blake, your official title, I imagine, would be racing manager for Looch Racing. How did you find him? How did you know about him? I don't think I knew who he was back at the time when we're talking about.
Well, when you're in the trenches every day and wagering every track across the country, it's, he's not a guy that's hard to find in person, because of those lime green silks and because he's always in the form. He's
Right.
running so many horses. But I'd heard this guy on the radio a few times, and he'd mentioned that, "I'm doing this all on my own. I've got 100 horses and nobody's helping me in this." And I thought, "Well, man, this guy probably needs some help."
Yeah.
So I reached out to him, and oddly, the phone rang the next morning, and it was him. And he said, "Can you get on a plane to Dallas?" And I said, "Yeah, no problem." So I got on a plane to Dallas, went and met him, and the following Monday I was working for him, and it's been that way for, going on 5 years now. So, it's you just never know what it's going to be each day with Ron Paolucci. That's the great thing about him.
No 2 days alike. I was going to say, just, I mean, as an outsider, I've had the pleasure of meeting him at the green room at Keeneland, and I have a little bit of a sense about who he is. But if I only knew him from some of the spots where the horses end up and maybe some of the quotes you read in the racing press, you might think he was kind of a mercurial individual. However, I can tell from your longstanding relationship that I doubt he's that way as a boss. How do you reconcile sort of the public Luch persona with the man that you know?
Yeah, it's, you know, Ron is Ron to me, but I understand to a lot of other people he's out of his mind, you know, so.
I wasn't going to say that, but.
Yeah, you know, no, I love the guy, and that's why I can say that, you know, and the reality of it is that Ron has got one of the biggest hearts that you're ever going to find. He's taught me so much about this game, and he is one of the sharpest horse people you'll ever meet. I mean, he is very, you know, aggressive with, you know, the way he likes to place horses in big races. But that aside, you can't win as many races as he's won. You can't, you know, win as many owner titles as he's won. And doing it on the budget that he has, I don't think there's anybody in our game that's doing what he's doing. So, you know, he catches a lot of slack for, you know, being aggressive, but all that said, he's got a heart of gold. He's, a stand-up guy, and, you know, he's just, you know, a wonderful guy to be around. And like I said, he's my boss. So he's number one in my eyes, but you got to just take the good with the bad and, you know, just accept that, you know, Ron's a guy that likes to play the game at a high level, you know?
Fair enough. What goes into being a racing manager? I think a lot of our listeners don't know too much about the game on that level. What's the day-to-day of that part of your job? And then how does betting factor into it in 2019?
Sure. You know, every day, you know, having living animals, there's stuff that is, you know, can go wrong and does go wrong. So a lot of my job is dealing with, you know, putting out small fires. Maybe this horse has to go to the equine hospital today, or this horse needs to be shipped from here to there. You know, this horse needs to be nominated, or you know, there's just several different day-to-day things that will come up that, you know, just have to be taken care of, whether it be licensing for, you know, a track that's we're getting ready to send horses to, or, you know, whether it's a sick horse or bills that need to be paid. There's so many different facets of it that have to be taken care of and handled. And, you know, it's, you got 100 racehorses, it's impossible for one guy to do it. So that's where I come into play. And I try to take as much, much of that off of his table, and so that he can sit back and watch his horses run and, you know, enjoy the game.
How much of the actual picking of the spots is you, or does he keep that pretty much as his own bailiwick?
Yeah, Ron is going to pick all his spots. You know, he will occasionally ask me my opinion on some things, but, you know, he's going to, you know, he pays these bills, and that's what he loves to do, is, you know, pick these spots. And, you know, I totally understand it. And, you know, it's worked good for us. And that's how that works.
I want to ask about that. I want to loop back to that question about betting and how much time mm-hmm. are you afforded to continue to, sure. to bet? Because you mentioned you're betting more now than when you were doing it for a living. I wasn't sure if you were just referring to contests or day to day. Talk about the role that betting plays in your life.
Yeah, I would say betting is, you know, it used to be an everyday thing. Now it's, you know, probably 4 days a week, you know, Wednesday, you know, through maybe Tuesday through Sunday. I would maybe take 1 or 2 days off a week. And that's, you know, about the time I give it now. And, you know, I'll play the whole card. Any card I go to play, I'm not just going to look at one race. I like to, you know, take the whole card and try to make something happen with it. And, you know, I would say that my volume is higher. I don't know if I'm putting in more time, but I'm putting in more money. I know that.
you're handling more in aggregate now than when you were back then.
Exactly.
How do contests fit into the current spectrum of your play?
Sure. Yeah, you know, the contests is something that I'll do that for the rest of my life, just because it's, I love competition and I love the camaraderie. So, like, for example, right now I've got mapped out the Del Mar contest, Chris Barr's contest out there in the end of July. I'll go out there and I'll go to the Saratoga contest in August. And I'll even go to the Arlington contest in around 4th of July. I believe Chris Pepsnick runs that one.
Indeed. Indeed. They have a chance to win a bunch of, I think it's NHC there, and it seems like a pretty good opportunity.
Well, yeah, no VIG. I mean, that's, anytime there's no rake, that's a great plus EV situation.
Where did you first get into contests? What was the impetus?
You know, it's funny. The first contest I ever played, I got into it because of this year's BCBC winner, actually, Chuck Grubbs.
Oh, cool.
He's the one that introduced me to contests. And the first one I played was, I believe, the Stephen Foster Churchill contest 2 or 3 years ago. It was the year JK won the NHC.
2015.
Tour. Yeah, so that would have been the year that I first played my first contest.
So, yeah, been at it now for 4 years or so. Chuck just encouraged you and said, hey, this is something you might want to check out. How did you
know? That's exactly it. Yep. Yeah, we were driving home from the Derby that year, and he said, you playing contests? I said, no. And he said, well, you ought to play. There's a great one coming up next week. I was like, okay.
That's excellent. Now, I'm going to just take a guess that Chuck and Ron were maybe friends through harness racing?
Yes, that is correct. Yep, they had some ties back to the Salkies.
Chuck is an amazing player. We got to get him on here to tell his whole story. You talk about the immense respect you have for professional players. I could just see you gravitating towards him and his life experience from the beginning. Is he an important person for you in your horse playing life?
Oh, yeah. Chuck and I speak every day, and I've got a great amount of respect for him. He is exactly what I was talking about. He's a guy that is in front of the monitors 24/7 and watching replays, betting, doing everything he can to find an edge. And that's what it takes. And he's a perfect example of it.
I want to ask you about your handicapping process and how it's evolved. You talked about being a trip handicapper, but I'm interested in what data you use and just some sense of what your process is. It sounds like you're comfortable looking at a whole lot of races around the country still.
Yeah. You know, it's a good point. Now, one thing I can tell you is that it's whoever makes the buyers, for example, it's not the same person making the buyers for every track.
Correct.
It's the same formula, but it's not the same person. So I've learned that whether it be the Thoroughgraphs or the Ragazins or the buyers, that each track, you know, for example, an 80 buyer is not going to translate the same for Belmont as it will Thistle Downs. It just doesn't. Now, why? I don't know, but that's just the reality of it. So I feel like I have an edge in being able to decipher, you know, is what is what when these horses are coming from other tracks and other venues. So that's one thing that, you know, that goes into my handicapping, so to speak, is that I may not treat this 80 buyer the same way I treat this 80 buyer. And same thing goes for the Ragazins. I'll use the buyers and the Ragazins, and I, you know, use the Ragazins to kind of help decipher. A lot of times in a race, I'll have, you know, maybe it's a 12 horse field and I got three horses I like. And for me, they all three look alike. You know, I can't separate them. The Ragazins do a good job for me of separating those three horses so that I can get a, you know, a true feel of which one I should be pressing and which one I shouldn't be pressing. So, and when I mean pressing, playing multiple times or, trying to hit it out of the ballpark, so to speak. So that's kind of the tools I use to try to, come to a solid conclusion.
With your trip work, are you doing that immediate aftermath of races and recording it in some sort of database form like Formulator? Or are you looking at a card for the first time, finding maybe a common race with four horses, and then going back and watching that race and tripping it from that point of view? How do you incorporate that?
Sure. When I see something happen in a race, I have a, I use a MacBook and I just go to my notes section and I just put date, race, name a horse, and just start typing. And I just got a database full of notes. And every day, I'll just go through my thing and I'll look and I'll say, oh, well, here I've got a horse, that was locked up, for the entire race and, had no room to run and, da 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 da. And I'll institute that into my play if it's worthy. But you got to be careful. A lot of this information that we're tracking is useless, honestly. But you got to be very careful of how high a value you're going to put on these this trouble, that you're highlighting, because it can lead to a lot of money loss if you're not careful.
And I'm going to guess what you mean at that, because I think some listeners will be like, wait, he's putting in all this work and he's saying it's often useless. But I think where you're going with that is just because a horse had a trip doesn't mean he fits in today's spot or is going to have the
That's
right pace
exactly it.
scenario. Yeah, you need to do handicapping beyond just,
It's
okay, here's a trip horse.
not an auto bet just because they're coming back.
Right. And I mean, how many notes do you think you're making just in an average day? I mean, are you picking out one or two?
It may be zero and it may be one or two, it's got to be something that at least piques my mind, like tells me, like, hey, there's, if this situation hadn't occurred, like this is a total different outcome. It's not even close. Like, that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for something that just, makes no sense. Like, this horse had no business routing today. Like, he never wanted to go this long. And, he's going to have a terrible running line coming back in his next start. And if he comes back sprinting in the right spot, I'm going to go to town. It's kind of how I look at it.
I think that's smart, trying to understand what connections are doing, whether it's a strategy or just poor placing, and then being able to capitalize when the horse gets back in the right spot. Especially when you're looking at a lot of races, sometimes I think you can get numb to just looking at PPs and say, oh, that's a bad race, this horse is out of form. Whereas if you're trying to capture it in real time, and you're almost like being able to tap into your brain the day you looked at that race and know, wait a second, not so fast, there's maybe something going on here. Does that.
Exactly. That's it. If I can, if I'm, my hope is to put those notes down so that when this situation comes back, this horse comes back in, everything from that day, everything from occurred from that last instance is going to be fresh on my mind so that I can, institute that in and into my handicapping.
I'm embarrassed to say that there's times where a note will come up on a horse and I'll read this detailed note and it's good, but I have no memory of making it or no memory, no primary memory of the original race. And then I can tell from talking to you that you've got a great memory. Our mutual friend Nick Tamaro, you talk to a guy like that. I envy you guys. I mean, not only are you both younger than me, but you're just much sharper.
Well, thank you, but I will say that Nick, I consider him to be the sharpest. But yeah, man, I can't believe you just kind of compared me to Nick, but all right.
You're remembering
Yeah.
details of a race you bet when you were 12. I can't do that.
Listen, the times we win, we never forget, Pete.
This is a difference in personality. I could tell you all about my bad beats. I think more there are the toppest of the top level, top 1% wins I remember pretty well. But
Yeah, I try to forget those.
I could, you give me an average bad beat from 6 years ago, I can quote you chapter and verse. I don't know. There's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with me, clearly. But in terms of the trip notes and how you manage them, do you have a service that emails you? You know, I think Equibase has one, DRF has one that tells you, when these horses are backing. You do that manually?
I use my own notes. Like I said, I have my own notebook, and I just type them in. And like I said, each day I do use the virtual stable now. I choose to not, write any notes there. But I do use the virtual stable with Equibase to, notify me when a horse is in. I do that, but I like to just, I'm kind of old school in that regard. I like to have my own notes and my own notebook.
I've got a few other areas I want to touch on that could spiral into lengthy conversation. So I'll cut right to those. You mentioned about getting married, and I didn't realize that your wife knew you back in those straight up grinding days. I think a lot of listeners can probably use some advice. And I mentioned Mike Maloney before, and he wrote about this extensively in Betting with an Edge. But what's the secret for a horse player to keep a strong relationship?
Honesty. From day one, I made sure to explain how much, how much I was into, horse racing, how much passion I had for it. So I would say that, you convey that, anybody that's, a true life partner for you is going to be, helpful in helping you try to, achieve what you want to do. So, being open about your ambitions is the best thing I can say is, definitely helped me.
Your partner has to accept you for who you are. I mean, it's as simple
as exactly
that.
It.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. And married life treating you guys well so far?
Absolutely. My wife actually has a few horses, and she's had 6 starts this year and 3 wins. So she's doing well.
You've got her percentage. Nice. That's that's great. So I've met her at the track a couple of times. She's obviously a little bit more than merely racing tolerant. I describe Susan as racing tolerant. She was out there for the Belmont. We had a good day. She likes it, but she's not really going out of her way, if I'm being honest with myself. Big days only kind of. And a couple of, a couple of times at Saratoga. Sounds like your wife is a little bit more into it than that.
Yeah, Raquel is, she's great. She's very much into it, and she enjoys the game.
I also wanted to ask you about your involvement overseas. I remember the first conversation you and I ever had. You saw, I think it was maybe back in 15 when I was going over to spend 4 months over there, and you had volunteered to talk to me about just the experience of betting overseas. How do you have this background? Do you still follow it? And then, of course, we'll drill down a little bit into Ask It, maybe, depending on how much you still follow.
Sure. I actually spent about a year in England, in the Reading, Tilehurst area, and visited several tracks while I was there. Visited the betting shops quite often. I would say that really was having that experience, Pete, was extremely important for me and my endeavors. And the reason I'll say that is, you'll know this being there now, is it's a gambling nation.
Yes.
Every corner you got a Coral or a Ladbrokes or there's something, that is to do with, betting. There's a betting shop on every corner just about. So being in an environment like that, it made me feel like, oh, this isn't something that's so, I'm not wrong for wanting to have ambitions to want to, do something in this industry. So I felt like that was very good for me, and being kind of submerged into all that gambling, really. I mean, it's kind of a taboo. It was a taboo topic. Growing up where I'm, in Indiana, it wasn't something that was really promoted or talked about other than the state lottery.
Right. How old were you when you were in England, and were you mostly betting their races or our races?
Yeah, good question. I was I was in my early 20s, just after college. So I was like 22, 23. And I remember frequenting just about every racetrack that I could drive to. I mean, I went to Bath, I went to Windsor, I went to Kempton, I went to Epsom, I went to Ascot, I went to, I went to several Greyhound tracks. I mean, I tried it all, you know. I wanted to, I even did the dog hurdles. I mean, that's talk about something that's, wow, watching dogs go over hurdles is something.
That's obscure.
Yeah, it's very obscure. I really appreciated that time period of my life, just being able to experience all the different facets of, racing.
Was it more for fun, or were you
Oh
essentially
no.
gambling for a
No,
living?
I was gambling for a living, trying to make money. That was the first time I ever had the opportunity to wager on American racing outside of, parimutuel pools.
I would have thought
And
that would have been an amazing, amazing edge for you, as it's been for me over the years. I mean, I don't think I could make money. If you made me be a professional bettor tomorrow, the first thing I would do would be to move there. I don't know that I could knock heads with these guys in these pools. I think I could win over there. I'm curious if you had a similar experience.
absolutely, 100%. I would find that it was almost, I want to say that I found it kind of easy in a way, but I also, it was kind of a, I want to, I'm searching for a word here. It was kind of, oh man, I'm drawing a blank here, but it's kind of like being in a different, like looking at a different language in a way, in my opinion, because everything, the TriCaster, the Forecaster, everything like that in the pounds, it was, you didn't really have the pick four. You had the accumulator. You had, there was, so it was a time in my life when I was a lot younger, and I'm trying to figure out, like, where is my edge here? What do I play? I'm able to bet against the house, and I don't even know where I should be attacking first here, So it was a lot of trial and error there, and a lot of trying to find my way. But what it ended up doing was, giving me a lot of knowledge for down the road, and a lot of aha moments came later down the road.
I want to talk about those aha moments, but I'm also curious what precipitated the move back to our shores.
During this time period, I was, dating a British girl. So this was all, basically precipitated off of, that relationship. So, we're still friends. That girl and I are still friends today, but fortunately, I'm married to my wife today and don't have to think about that life anymore. But,
Sounds like when that relationship ran its course, it was just time to come back home.
exactly. That's it. Yeah, that's exactly it.
And you talked about the lessons you learned. I mean, for me, when you're betting fixed odds, especially when you're betting fixed odds early on, I just think you learn a better intuitive sense of value than in parimutuel, where you'll never meet an American player who can bet on 5-2 shots that should be 8-5, because you can't learn that skill here because you don't know what price you're getting. But
Exactly.
I feel like I've learned that difference over there. And if you give me fixed odds, I can live on that margin, or at least do okay on that margin. And it's just, to me, it's a tremendous advantage. And I think it trains your brain to understand value in a way that we're not afforded to over here. Do you think that's right or an exaggeration?
No, you're very much right. It's, when I, going back to when I was over there, the very first way of me doing things, just from common sense, was, doing the handicapping, and then literally, when I was be at the track, I'd go from, they look like little hot dog stands, these little bookmakers, and I would just go from, bookmaker to bookmaker, looking at their odds board and shopping my odds. And if my horse was longer odds over here. Obviously, I'm going to go make my bet over here. So that was really my first introduction to, you know, value shopping.
Yeah.
And that's really where the light bulb went on for me, and like figuring out what value is and how to go find it.
These days in the USA, which pools are you the most active in?
Multi-race pools. I'm my wife calls me a pick four whore.
You never met a pick four at this point? You won't play? Is that what I'm hearing?
That's basically what it is. Yeah. I don't know what it is, but I do know for certain what it is that, you know, draws me to it. And it's knowing that I only have to pick a winner. And that for me is a breath of fresh air.
And in terms of finding your edge, you talked about how you believe you can get an edge in your handicapping, having a great sense of class going from circuit to circuit. Makes sense as a racing manager for a place that runs horses all over that you'd have that sense. But what about on the wagering side? Are you doing anything special to try to maximize value and get an edge?
Well, you know, I'm not using any computer programs or anything like that. I have a way of, finalizing my selections and stuff, but, the tools I use, Pete, are, I love using the double probables. I love using the will pays, just basic stuff that's available to everybody out there. And I just try to take that information and apply it to what I'm looking at. And then from there, I try to leverage my money in the best way possible and, you know, hope for the best.
Are you looking at the sort of ABC strategy? Are you doing something like that, more intuitive, or are you okay just doing something more akin to what we might call caveman tickets because, you know, you feel like the signal in the betting is strong enough that you're going to be able to come out okay?
Well, that's a good point. And I am neither for or against caveman tickets. I play them sometimes. But I do use the ABC method, and until somebody shows me a better method, I'm going to keep on using that, because when you're right, you need to be hitting that thing multiple times, period. Because it's hard to be right. You know, it's not easy to cold deck something and to get it right. So when you are right, by golly, you need to get, you need to reap the benefits. So the ABC method really just, it ensures that when you're right, you're going to hit that thing properly.
Are you more inclined to go narrow in your pick four bets, or are you more inclined to spread, or does it just depend on the sequence?
It's all sequence dependent. If we're talking about a sequence of four races that have, 10 plus horses in each race, and, a average post time favorite of, 5-2 in each race, then, I may consider that caveman option, because, mm-hmm. It's more conducive for a big payoff. Now, if this is a sequence where I'm just flat out against a big, 1-2 shot or something like that, then I'm going to make sure that if my opinion is correct, that I hit it. I'm not going to, that's the worst feeling in the world, is when you're right but wrong. Oh man.
You're talking to a Tacitus backer. So I feel like I have had that experience very recently, if I do say so myself. Do you feel like in contests, not having your favorite bet, the pick four, is that a difficult thing? Does that make contests a little bit harder for you? And how do you make the adjustment?
It does. It's funny you bring that up, because, my daily, grinding play is, pick fours, pick fives. And you go into these contests and, you have a double available to you. But, what I've noticed about these doubles is you got these guys like Jonathan Kenshin that will just go in there and completely take all the money out of the pool. So, it's tough to make it on the doubles in the contest, but it is a little bit tougher for me to transition on a contest day into that. But with that being said, the win bet is still the best thing to cure that.
sure, you can sort of make your own pick and you don't have to play every race in the sequence. But it is interesting that it was essentially a bottom-up tri-key that got you there. Was that just because of this one situation, or do you think that's a bet you might be a little bit inclined to do a little bit more of, at least in the contest world?
You know, I've always, when I play vertically, I've always been a guy that likes to try to find the horses that I like in the race that are value and play off of those. That's kind of how I've always formulated those type of tickets. So I'll continue to keep doing it. Now more of it, I may look to, you know, parcel out some more of my play for situations like that, because it, you know, in a way it did remind me that, you know, it doesn't take a pick five and a pick four to have a score like that, you know? So, it's good to have that.
I'll add the idea that I feel like long shots, a lot of the time, it's easier to find ones. I mean, just on the math, they run second and third a lot more than they win. So if in
Absolutely.
Your handicapping you find them, you know, you can have that in the pick four, that great long shot that runs second or third at 20-1 doesn't get you anything. Whereas in the vertical pools, it's a way to be a day maker, if not contest maker, if not something even better than that, if you can hit it right and just combine with the logicals. I know in my own play when I look at them, I think, you know, I really should be doing a little bit more in the vertical pools, especially when you can find those situations. I'll ask you one more and then I'll let you get out of here because I've kept you longer than I said already. But you talked about the situations that you look for. Clearly, pace situations are one of them when you scope out a sequence and say, okay, I want to get involved in there because I think it's going to be a meltdown or a lone front runner. What's another Blake Jesse situation that you might find when looking over a 2-day contest card where you just know you're going to want to try to get your money in good?
You know, I love horses that are, you know, the public darling horses, kind of, you know, like trying to give you an example here, like a Bellafina, mm-hmm. You know, where you just, the public seems to like become enamored and in love with a horse and you are the opposite about them. that's, you know, I love those situations because it's number one, you're getting a big pool to play into. And if you're right, you know, there's going to be a lot of money to go around. So that's one situation. But getting back to the pace situation, you know, I still have not found a better, you know, situation than two dead red speed horses being in the same race. You know, when you have two horses that have two way and they only have one way of going, which is on the lead and I'm going to die trying to get there. It's not a better situation to be a part of. I mean, it's physics. They're going to come back to you. I mean, it's just the bottom line.
Will you try typically in that situation to play against both of them or try to
Absolutely.
Separate them?
I'll play against both of them and, you know, I'll play them in multi races and I'll play, horizontal too. But, you know, the other major situation that I really, you know, feel like I excel at is, you know, starting pick threes and pick fours, pick fives even. The first race of these sequences is the only race that the bettors can see the odds of the horses. So beating the favorite in the first leg for me is always like going to be more valuable than beating the favorite in the second or third or fourth leg. Mm-hmm. So I've always, you know, tried to use that as a, you know, as a kind of a little angle. And, you know, this is kind of funny, but when I was, you know, kind of a smaller player, I would always, you know, play the pick three in a race where the pick four starts. And I would do that because I felt like, a player like myself today, I'm never touching that pick three pool. I'm going to be playing the pick four pool because it's the one that's got the big pool. And back then I had the thinking that if I play this pick three pool, I'm not going to have to be playing against all these sharp tycoon players. I'm going to get a pool that's got a much lower IQ in it. So that's kind of something that I did back in the day and would have some success with. Felt like I would get a little higher payoff than what I should, simply because those whales weren't in that pool. They were
I love that
focused
idea.
On a bigger pool.
I love that idea of the pool IQ. Mike Maloney's talked about that, focusing on when there's a big day, whether it's Breeders' Cup or Kentucky Derby, looking around at other tracks historically was something he would have done. Same idea, game selection in poker. Now, of course, it's changed so much, and I'll keep you on here for one more because of this, because we went down this road. It's changed so much with the advent of the computer betting, where you can get this sharp, scalable computer money showing up in any pool, anywhere, virtually.
Exactly.
Is that strategy gone out of your arsenal, or in general, with the amount that you bet, are there any strategies you've developed to try to specifically deal with the fact that there's so much sharp computer money being bet around the country?
Well, yeah. When I have a big opinion, I've learned that you get your money in early. Don't wait till late, because if you wait late, what'll happen is that the computers won't have a chance to adjust to what their data is telling them to do. So if you get your money in early, they can at least adjust and, bet the other combinations and, where they see a deficiency, and, basically make your payoff, if you're correct, higher than what it would have been if you bet late. So if I'm betting a $5,000 bet or something, I'm going to make sure I get that in at 15, 20 minutes to post, so that, maybe a little later so I can get a look at the horse in the paddock, but I'm going to make sure at least, 8 to 10 minutes to post, I get that bet in so that the computers can have a chance to, run their software and, play the other variables.
Absolutely. Get the other combos. You mentioned looking at horses in the paddock. So I gotta grab you there. At what point did you develop that skill, and how important is it to what you do?
Yeah, hanging around trainers and horse people, you ask questions, and what I've learned is everybody's willing to give you an answer, right or wrong. So I, would just ask questions, what are you looking at, what should I be looking at, and that sort of thing. And the best advice I can give to anybody for looking at horses in the paddock, you've already done your handicapping at this point. So I'm looking for just, a check mark, basically. It's something that tells me, okay, yep, everything looks good here. Go ahead and go with your opinion. So when I look in the paddock, I'm looking to see that the horse is not looking around at everything. I don't want him distracted. I don't want any erratic head movement. I don't want any kidney sweat. I don't want them, exerting any undue energy. Mm-hmm. I want them just to, have their mind on business. And if possible, I'd like them to be looking at the ground and have a bowed neck and dappled out if possible. But, as long as their mind is on business and they're not, spending any undue energy, I'm okay with going along with my opinion and, firing. So that's how I use the paddock.
You won't throw one in on looks. You're just more likely to take one that you were going to bet and take them out. That's what I'm hearing.
I will backtrack there, because I will throw one in on looks as long as there's something to go along with it. Like, I'm throwing this one in on looks because it also has pedigree, mm-hmm. It's trying the turf for the first time or, something like that. But man, it's hard to just throw one in on looks because, I didn't grow up around horses. It's hard for me to, say that, that horse just winked at me. Oh, man.
All right, Blake, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate you taking so much time out and sharing so much with me and the In the Money listeners. It's been a great pleasure.
Hey, you're very welcome, Pete. Thanks for having me on.
And that's going to do it for this edition of the In the Money Players podcast. We'll thank JK in absentia for all the fine work he's been doing. And I want to thank, of course, Blake Jesse. Shout out to our sponsors, Stats Race Lens, Black Type Thoroughbreds, 10 Strike Racing, and the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation in particular. Most of all, I want to thank all of you, the listeners. Hopefully you're going to enjoy this show as much as we enjoyed recording it. This show has been a production of In the Money Media. In the Money Media's business manager is Drew Cotney. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos.